everyone, and welcome to Minute 31 of Season 3 of Movie Hour Minutes, the Daily Podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick, Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Matthew Simpson of Awesome Friday. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Well, thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Hopefully we'll have some interesting things to talk about this week. A few little threats, bloodstains, bumps on the head. You know, we got some normal things this week. You know, typical for Die Hard.
Yeah. Hopefully no cut-up feet, so, but otherwise we're good.
No cut-up feet yet. We're going to have to wait a few weeks for that one. But yeah. So episode 31 begins with McClane entering the boardroom stealthily and ends with Hans making another fashion comment. So, you know, we ended things on Friday with Hans and Takagi in the boardroom. Mm-hmm. And Takagi, and now the audience, has just found out that we're not dealing with terrorists here. We're actually dealing with people who are here to steal $640 million worth of bearer bonds. So, yeah, that's not something that one would expect. You know, I love the way that it takes a half hour for us to actually find this out, where we think that it's terrorists. And, like, on all the posters, you know, terrorists take over the Nakatomi building. I love the fact that they get it wrong and they say 12 terrorists take over. And they're actually 13 if you count properly. So.
Yeah, it's all kind of a really nice little misdirect, isn't it? Because the whole film up to this point has set them up as terrorists on some cause, but it's right now when we learn that they're basically just thieves, exceptional thieves, as we'll learn later in the film.
Exceptional thieves, yeah.
But yeah, thieves nonetheless.
So that works really well.
Yeah, and this minute, I find this minute, this whole 5 minutes that we're going to be covering this week, I find to be one of my favorite scenes of the movie, actually. So thank you for giving it to me.
It was by accident. It didn't, you know. I love how these things sometimes work, you know, completely kismet.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to plan ahead. You just say, okay, why don't you take this random group? And most of the time, I've had, you know, this is my third season doing this. Most of the time, you know, at least what my guests say is that they love the week that they got. Hopefully, they actually mean it. You know. So I mean, I did have one person complain about getting credits, but then we had a 2 50-minute conversations on those episodes. So you never know, you know, it's like Forrest Gump says, you know, life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
True.
So
true.
It all depends on what you have to talk about.
Well, I don't really like these scenes because at least the first, this one in particular is quite Alan Rickman heavy, and that's never a bad thing.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Alan Rickman is the real star of this movie. I mean, we all love Bruce Willis, and this is the movie that made him Bruce Willis. You know, there's no question about that. But
no.
It's Alan Rickman who steals every single moment that he's in this movie.
Yeah, as he's, you know, want to do in most things that he's in, really.
Yeah, but this was his first
role
in a movie.
Yeah, it's his film debut. So. And I don't, it wasn't Bruce Willis's, but yeah, you're right. It was definitely Bruce Willis's big breakout. Because he was, at this time, he was sort of best known for Moonlighting, and also for a series of, I think, coffee commercials, wasn't it, in the 80s? He did a series of commercials for something.
Had he started those coffee commercials beforehand? I don't remember.
Yeah.
That I don't remember. I mean, he was also like the 12th person that they offered this role to.
Yeah.
You know, it was like some crazy number of people, you know, all said no.
Yeah.
Which I wonder how many of them, probably most of them, are kicking themselves, you know, decades later that they should have taken. Richard Gere, you know, was the first person that they wanted to give this role to.
I mean, everyone always has good reasons to turn stuff down, right? Like, I think the more famous.
And then they complain afterwards, though.
Yeah. I mean, the more famous contemporary one would be Will Smith turning down The Matrix, right? To be in Wild West.
I was just
West,
thinking that, yeah.
Of all things.
Yeah.
But on paper, Wild Wild West looked like a slam dunk, so why wouldn't you make that? The choice makes sense. If you think about it in the moment. In hindsight, not at all.
Right.
But in the moment.
Exactly. Like, well, it's the same thing with Die Hard. I'm assuming that on paper, it just seemed like, okay, just another typical action movie, and that was it.
Yeah.
You know, Richard Gere wasn't apparently interested in another action movie, and so he passed on it. And, you know, no one ever thought that it would be a movie that spawned a genre.
Yeah, so, it's true.
You know, certain things just happen when you're not expecting them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, what can I tell you? So the minute starts off with John entering the boardroom. You know, we have this conversation going on between Hans and Takagi. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love here, and I didn't notice this till I did the research now, is if you look at the subtitles, you can actually find out what the conversation is between Hans and Takagi that is continuing. Because John hears muffled voices, but we can't really hear what they're saying. But if you read the subtitles, you can see he goes, "Mr. Takagi, I sympathize with your reluctance, but I'm sure you realize you're not dealing with anything significant here. It's not as if it's the education of your children. The bonds represent, at most, 10 days operating capital for your parent organization. It's really no more than a temporary inconvenience," which says so much, because you find out from this that Hans is actually trying to convince him that, you know, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
You know, don't argue with it. Just give me the code and that's it.
Yeah, I rewatched. To be fair, I didn't watch the whole thing this morning, but I rewatched the first half of this movie this morning before I got distracted by other things. And
well, at least you saw the part that at least you saw the first 35 minutes.
Yeah,
you
know, I definitely got through our time. one of the things I noticed, because I you know, separately watched the minute clips and then read the transcript of those clips, and I noticed because I was watching on my laptop with headphones that I actually could hear everything he was saying quite clearly, which was I'm sure it's been there. It's one of those things that's been there the whole time, but I had never noticed it before. But it's such a
right. No, I heard it also when I was listening to it, but I'm saying I never noticed it beforehand.
Yeah, and it's
that was such a
great setup for what's about to happen, and also it allows them to like build context for Hans Gruber and for his whole plan, while also building tension for John, who's hiding in the next. In the next room. It's kind of masterful work, actually. When
yeah, it really is. I mean, we discussed this a little bit last week with my guest DJ about the fact that, you know, Hans compartmentalized the whole plan. You know, he knows the entire plan, but he doesn't tell anyone.
Yeah, he's the only one.
He doesn't tell anyone everything. And the question that DJ and I posed was okay, what's the reason that he didn't tell everyone the plan? Is it because, you know, he's like the Joker, where the idea is that, okay, everyone does their part and then I'm going to get rid of them? Or is it the opposite, that he's scared that if everybody knows the entire plan, they're going to get rid of him?
I think that either is equally plausible. I would tend to lean towards the latter, that like as the mastermind,
right,
you keep... You know, his one big job is to keep all the pieces moving. And not only does it keep anyone from trying to take over the plan, it also allows him to have his subordinates on his team focus entirely on their one part, which they all do.
Right. Correct. Yeah, for sure.
So, like, Clarence Gilliard, like, doesn't really know anything other than about the safe. But that's all he needs to know to make the plan work. And as long as he trusts Hans, then the plan works, then they all get rich.
Right.
You know, it's
exactly
effective management by delegation, basically.
Yes, completely. I mean, that's the way he does this. I mean, the whole Hans does everything as if he has a business plan.
Yeah.
You know, he's giving out instructions to everybody, you know, as a business official, you know, as the, like the boss.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't act at all like one would expect a villain to act, which is one of the reasons why he's one of the best villains in any movie.
Yeah. I also just like that he is super well-dressed like everyone else is. And it sort of, it reflects his position on the team, not only as the leader, but as like the face of what's going on, not only to the hostages, but to the police and to John. Although John doesn't meet him until later, but you know, he's the one that they all have to look to and trust and believe. So he's the best dressed among all of them, wearing like a very nice slick suit, as opposed to the like sweatsuits and, you know, tank tops and casual sweaters.
What the rest of them are wearing. Yeah. Well, they're wearing European clothes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
That's the
the height of 80s fashion, I'm sure.
Yes, completely.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, why not?
Yeah, I mean, it's all
so
all
John. Yeah, for sure. So John is still in the model area, you know, underneath the model of Indonesia that we saw, which looks amazing. There's no question about that. The people who did the production design on that definitely get kudos for creating some great models in that room.
Yeah, I mean, the production design of all of the sets is pretty. I mean, a lot of it is just, you know, excessive 80s boardrooms and such, but it's all really well done. It's all really immaculate, I thought.
Right. So at this point, you know, John, I like the fact that we keep seeing the perspective from John and the perspective in the boardroom. You know, you get the inside outside look at what's going on, you know, because we want to also, as viewers, be able to see things up close, but also see it from afar, you know, how it's perceived and stuff like that.
It's important. You know, John being the protagonist, although Hans does steal every scene that he's in, I think it's important that, you know, as in from the audience point of view, we know what John knows. And so we often, you know,
right,
even though we're getting an inside-outside perspective, we're only hearing things that John would be able to hear.
Mostly, but there are things that we hear. I mean, the whole idea that this is a robbery, you know, we learn that, and John doesn't know that. He doesn't find that out until much later.
I guess that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
You know. Right. And so then we get a shot of Hans, you know, sitting calmly at the boardroom table. And then he goes, "Now the code, please." And as he's doing this, you see that he's unscrewing the silencer from the gun. Now, why would you think he's doing that? So that everyone can hear the shot.
I think it's just an intimidation move, honestly.
But the intimidation move to Takagi or everyone downstairs? Because they are a few floors down, you don't know if they're really going to be able to hear a shot or not.
Yeah, that's fair. I think.
I'm assuming it's not shoddy, you know, construction. these, you know, offices and the buildings, you know, they're going to be pretty soundproof. Especially, I mean, they're in the boardroom. You don't want people to be able to hear what's going on in a boardroom in a multi-billion dollar company.
That's true. I think it might. For me, it feels just like an intimidation move for Takagi, just that, like, he's handling the gun. He's setting up what he's about to do, or what he might be about to do in this minute. And then if he does have to use the gun, that noise will reverberate. It's also just from a, you know, filmmaking point of view, a loud gun is more effective in a scene like this, or in what's about to happen anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I do. Yes. I think it's just that he's...
In a week like this.
Yeah, I think he's just... I think he's just handling the gun to make it clear he knows how to handle the gun in front of Takagi.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like, he just places the gun on the side, on the desk, which is also done very interestingly, the way that he places it down and stuff like that. And then Takagi responds, "It's useless to you. There are 7 safeguards on our vault, and the code key is only one of them. You'll never get it open." And, you know, Takagi has been quite confident up until now, but we get to see that he's starting to sweat. He's nervous. I don't know if he's nervous that he thinks he's going to get shot, but I think the fact that he found out that this is a robbery just turned everything on end for him.
Yeah.
You know, he thought he knew what's going on, and then here, wait a second, they're here just to steal this money. So I don't know. I mean, I do like the fact that we can barely hear him, hear Hans say to him, you know, that it's only 10 days operating capital for your parent organization, because that would make it belittle the amount of money that they're taking from here. Meaning, if Hans's excuse is that your company is not even going to notice it, they're not going to notice $640 million, which as of today, I did the calculation last week, it's like $1.5 billion dollars. Okay. What company is not going to notice $1.5 billion missing from, you know, from their
yeah, that's money? True.
So I'm sort of glad that I didn't know about this until, you know, doing the research for this minute right now, because it takes away from the impact of taking so much money.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting.
You know, it's like someone saying, "I'm going to steal $5 from your pocket." You know, like, okay, you know, I'll feel the loss of the $5, but you know, it's not going to take that long for me to get over
Yeah,
it.
I also just like that in this minute in particular, Gruber is very purposefully trying to be like the subtext of what he's saying is, I don't want to shoot you. Like, just give me the codes. I'd rather not shoot you. Like, is what it feels like he's trying to say, you know, between the lines. But he's make sure the gun is there to say, like, but I will. You know, if you don't like your choices here are give me the codes or not that, right? Like, it's
That's right.
you know, you can give me the codes and you can
Exactly.
lose $600 million, or you can, you know, not live to see what that looks like.
Correct.
Yeah,
Or I'm going to get them
exactly.
anyway, you know. And then Hans' response is, then there's no reason not to tell it to us.
I love how
And,
reasonable he's
you know,
being to this
the.
point.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And at this point, he picks up the gun and switches it to his left hand. You know, you know, he's looking around. And now the question is, do you think Takagi is trying to stall at this point? Do you think he realizes that he's in a precarious situation and needs to try and stall?
Yeah.
Or is it just his
Yeah,
nervousness?
I think what you said before about how he thought he was dealing with one type of person and is just realizing that he's dealing with an entirely different kind of person has sort of thrown him for a loop. And I think he's trying to gauge how reasonable Gruber is. And it's kind of like he's the next thing he after Gruber says that there's no reason not to give it to you, Dois, and I think the next line from Takagi is, well, you're just gonna have to kill me then. Feels like an, or is that the
No,
next one?
that's just tomorrow. That's
Oh, that's
tomorrow.
tomorrow. Okay. I thought that.
We don't get there. We don't get there till
Right.
tomorrow. But that is the next line from Takagi. Yes.
And I feel like at,
But you know,
sorry, I feel like at this point Takagi's just trying to sort out who exactly he's dealing with and deciding whether or not he's gonna roll the dice on it. Which would be nerve-wracking for anyone, let alone a you know, he's the CEO of this multi-billion-dollar corporation. He's used to these high-pressure negotiations. I just think he's not used to having a gun in his face while he's doing it.
Yes. No, and the question is, does he really believe that Hans is going to shoot him?
I
Does he
fully,
think it's just a threat?
yeah, I fully think he doesn't at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he figures that out at any point. And then I love the fact that I had a good friend that I saw this movie with tons of times on cable and video when it came out. His name is Josh Zwelling. He's probably not listening to this because I haven't been in touch with him in years, but whatever. If you are listening, Josh, just shout out to you. And he's the one who pointed out to me the fact that, you know, as this is all going on, we get a shot of Carl and Theo. And, you know, basically, he goes, "I told you." And he goes, "It's not over yet." And the idea that the two of them are having a bet as to what's going on here. We don't know what their bet is at this point, and we'll later in the week we'll try to infer who well we'll know later in the week who's siding with what. But I just love the fact that, you know, here you have a villain that's getting ready to shoot somebody, and you have two henchmen sitting on the side betting on the fact of, is he going to shoot him or not?
Yeah, it
You
gives
know,
such a
and it's just like
wonderful,
it's a throwaway line.
yeah, it gives such wonderful texture to the side characters, which I think this
Yes.
movie in particular is pretty good at. Not maybe not all of them, but certainly to
Yeah.
those two, they get a lot of interesting screen moments that could have been just very bland or no dialogue at all. But all the dialogue they do get is super interesting and super
Yeah, for sure.
super engaging. Clarence Gilliard in particular, who's character name escapes me as I said his name out loud.
Theo.
Theo, yeah.
Theo.
I find every time he's on screen in this movie, I find him entertaining.
Yeah.
Like, you know, whether if there's a scene we're going to get with him in the in a couple of days, but even in the very beginning, which you would have already been through when he comes into the building and they shoot the guard at the front
Where
door
he's,
and he's just humming to himself as he's hacking the elevators and such. I love that scene. I love how just sort of aloof and, probably sociopathic he is in this movie. It's great.
completely. I mean, it's just great the way that he does it. And then Hans goes back to talking about fashion again and goes, "That's a very nice suit, Mr. Takagi." And we'll have to wait to find out what the continuation of that is, because that's where this minute ends. So, do you have anything else you want to say about the minute before we get into the script discrepancies?
No, just that whenever he says that's a nice suit, all I can think about is a cat, looking at a glass of water saying that's it'd be a shame if something happened to that. which I think might be the opening line of our next of tomorrow, but it's yeah, I can't help but picture one of them. I have three cats, and I can't help but picture one of them just looking at me with a paw against something they're going to knock over.
Okay. I'm not a cat person, so I can't relate, but I understand what you're saying. So the script has a few discrepancies here, not that many. So first of all, the entire dialogue that we talked about that you can sort of hear but can't really hear. So it's not in the script at all. It says that McLean can hear the mumble of voices from the conference room. So I love the fact that they decided to actually add dialogue there and not just make it that we hear muffled sounds and that's it.
Yeah, and I
So
wonder if that
I think that's
was,
great.
do we know if that was an on-set like rewrite or just like the actors winging it, or it must have been an
I'm
on-set,
assuming it's
right?
not. It must have been a rewrite on set. That's what I would think. This doesn't sound like something that Alan Rickman would just ad lib.
Yeah, it's a bit too
That's the
precise,
time.
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Then one of the things also in the script, instead of him putting the gun on the table, he puts it in his pocket.
Oh, on
And
the table is
then,
much better.
yeah, for sure. No, because Takagi sees the gun in front of him. So obviously. And the final thing is, first of all, in the script, it does have Theo and Carl saying, "I told you," and it's not over. So that was already planned beforehand. That isn't an ad lib, because that would have been a great ad lib if they would have done that. But after they say that, it says Hans gives them both a look like an annoyed schoolmaster and then turns back to Takagi.
Mean,
I just love descriptions in scripts.
it's a pretty great one too.
Correct.
Because
All right, so
yeah, now that you've said that, I can't remember if he actually gives that look, but I can see him giving that look in my head. It just,
he gives them a look. He
yeah.
does give them a look.
You see, as soon as you said it, I was like,
As he's
did he
doing
give him a look? But in my head, it doesn't matter because I can very clearly picture Alan Rickman giving him
it.
that look.
No, he does. He looks at them in a very stern fashion and then looks back at Takagi and then starts talking about the fashion jargon once again. Now, I mean, what do you think Hans is expecting or suggesting by him starting to say, "That's a nice suit"?
Well, I mean, I know what's about to happen in the next, like, what we'll talk about
No,
tomorrow.
I know, I know, I know.
Same
I'm just
thing.
kidding. Tomorrow we'll get to that. it's interesting that it gets cut off right there, because it would have been it cuts him off mid-thought. But that happens to us a few times this week. When you're cutting things down by the minute, you can't always choose where you're going to
Yeah,
cut it.
true.
What can I tell you? Right. So every Monday we do a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guests will give their top five Die Hard doppelganger movies. So what have you got for us,
So
Matthew? Start from number five
I
and
had
work your way up.
a hard time with this, to be totally honest. But
No, lie to me.
and it's actually amazing how I made a list, and a lot of them were from the 90s. But I'm gonna go with my number five being the 1993 Sylvester Stallone classic Cliffhanger, which is just Die Hard on a Mountain, where he's fighting Also thieves, you know, masquerading as terrorists, but they're just thieves. They've robbed a money plane, and the plane crashed. The money's on the side of the mountain, and him and his mountain climbing buddies are fighting back. For number four, I'm going to go with 1996 Executive Decision, which is a Kurt Russell Ooh. Starring Die Hard, yeah. but on a plane. And I like this movie. I mean, it's even better now because this person has turned out to be kind of garbage. But I really enjoy how, at the time, I have very distinct memories of this being advertised as a Steven Seagal movie. And the first thing that happens is that he dies. Like, in the first, like...
Yes. The truth is, I don't remember being... advertised as a Seagal movie, but I remember the fact that this was the first Seagal movie where Seagal dies. No, sorry for spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen the Executive Decision, but that might actually be a plus that people want to go see it because they get to see, you know, the first movie where Steven Seagal plays a character.
I don't think it's a spoiler either because it's literally like it's in the first like 20 minutes. It's as soon as the action starts.
Yeah. No, I think it's a little. Is it 20 minutes? Probably a little further.
It's been a while since I've seen it. Basically, as soon as they try to get to the plane,
right? Well, he does it heroically. He doesn't die like a chump.
But it also has a couple of great supporting performances from Halle Berry and John Leguizamo too. So, yeah. So for my number I'm going to cheat slightly and say the 2014 film The Equalizer, but just the third act, because most of the movie is not Die Hard, but the third act of that movie is very much Die Hard but in a hardware store. I don't know, have you seen that one?
Yeah, I've seen it. I'm not the biggest fan, you know. I'm not the biggest Denzel fan. Interesting. And especially when they're trying to remake something that worked so well in the 80s.
I'm sort of mixed on the movie, but I really enjoy the sequence at the end where it's just him facing off against a bunch of bad guys in a hardware store. I think it works
pretty well. Okay, that's fair.
So for number two, let's go with The Rock, which is a very loosely a Die Hard movie because there's two of them.
Yeah.
But there's two of them against a bunch of bad guys who are also trying to steal stuff. It's set in Alcatraz. Yeah, bad guys.
Who aren't really bad guys.
Not all bad guys. But
they're not all bad guys.
Pretty bad guys. And there's two of them instead of just one. But it's a wonderful pairing of Manic Nick Cage and, you know, Sean Connery having the most fun I think he maybe ever had.
Yep.
It's a super fun. And it's also maybe... I know a lot of it's probably my second favorite Michael Bay movie. I know it's a lot of people's first favorite Michael Bay movie, and it's his first really big movie. So, yeah, it's a good one. Now I just want to watch The Rock.
Well, wait till we finish recording this week, and then
I'm going to cheat for my number one too. I'm going to choose two movies, and I'm going to choose them because they are effectively the same movie. And one of them is 2011's The Raid, and the other is 2012's Dread, both of which feature a police officer in a high-rise building fighting off a building full of gangsters. The former of which being the set in Indonesia, directed by Gareth Edwards, and featuring intense martial arts action, and the latter being a Alex Garland adapted version of the long-running British comic book story. With admittedly not a lot of the satire that the comic features, but all of the violence and a perfect casting of Carl Urban. So I really like both of those movies, and I couldn't separate them because they are beat for beat, to say.
Right. All right. Well, I have a little bit of a problem with you doing that because I tally it up later. So I don't know how I would tally that up because I can't give them both fives. You know, I can't give them both points. So are you basically saying I should drop Cliffhanger off the list?
Drop off Cliffhanger and put The Raid at the top. So The Raid, Dread, down.
Nope.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. That makes sense. All right, great. Thank you very much for that. Well, do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yes, the easiest way to get in touch with me is to check out the website awesomefriday.ca, because we are based in Canada. We're on all the socials, Instagram and Twitter at awesomefridayca and Facebook Awesome Friday. And our main output is our Awesome Friday podcast, which you can find pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts.
All right, cool. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe to any podcatcher that you might be using to listen to this show. You can find me very simply. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. Or you can go to my website, movierobminute.com. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay. Woo!